From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Aaron Kaster, and welcome to The Green Majority. This week, we've got a bit of a show that's going to jump around a little bit for you as we're trying to throw some last-minute details here together. We've got some stuff about the Stop Plan B in the PEI. This has to do with the Kent Trinita Highway that's being edited and put across. Sorry, folks, a little bit of live radio action there going on. Let me start again. We're going to be talking about the Stop B Trans-Canada Highway in Prince Edward Island, which has to do with rerouting Trans-Canada through Bonshaw and New Haven using funds from the Federal Atlantic Gateway Fund. There's an environmental opposition to this, part of having to do with the fact that they're cutting down a rather nice area, but we're going to hear from someone live on the ground having to do with that. Then following that issue, we're going to be dealing a little bit with the food system and restaurants. We'll be having some more TED Talks coming up right up after that. But first, we will actually go. I believe we're going to have him on the line in just a second now to talk about the Stop Plan B Bonshaw PEI. And hopefully that'll be coming through. Also, to remind people, we're going to be trying doing a little bit more of a live aspect to the show. We don't really have the systems to be doing live call-ins. So for now, unless you actually hear her voice on the air, Leah is going to be sitting at the computer. So if you have any questions, comments, concerns about the show, you can always go ahead and send us an email as well. But you can send her something live during the show if you are so inclined and are able. If you have any questions or concerns or comments, as I said, about the show, you can tweet to @GreenMajority. Leah's there, and she will be your voice for you. Anything from our live guests, or if you have comments. We're also going to be doing a little bit of a free-form discussion later in the program having to do with some bicycle laws, some proposed laws, maybe getting into some other stuff as well. For now, we're going to be going live on the ground to PEI. Peter, are you there?
Yes, hi there. How are you, Darren?
Not too bad. A little bit disorganized this morning, and unfortunately, as you may be able to tell, but we're going to pull through it. So if you want to just go ahead and introduce yourself again and just give us a little bit of a background about what's actually going on with the Trans-Canada Highway.
Sure. Well, I'm standing at the side of the Trans-Canada Highway in the middle, central PEI, and the government has proposed and pushed through a realignment of a 6-kilometer section here. Which is going through the middle of some old-growth Acadian forest, which is an increasingly rare entity in this part of the world. And there are many, many other issues related to this financial craziness surrounding the cost of the highway and a lack of public consultation. But, I mean, from a green perspective, certainly an ecological perspective, the loss of the old-growth forest is our biggest concern.
And so what the... On the website that you have there, there's a few things that are outlined having to do with the flawed process. So do you want to just explain what you mean by that? You have the environmental concern because you don't obviously want this forest to be cut down,
yep.
The old growth forest. But what talk a little bit about the you're saying how the islanders were not involved in the process. What was the sort of democracy issue here?
Yeah, sure. Well, right from the very beginning, and this has been going on almost exactly a year now, Darren, the government came to the people with several proposals of how to spend money that we don't have, by the way, because we're so crippled by debt at the moment, like every other jurisdiction in Canada. But they came to us with several proposals for realigning the Trans-Canada Highway in such a way that they could gain some access to federal funds through the Atlantic Gateway Fund. If they were to do that, the feds would kick in with 50% of the money up to a certain amount, and we could have our roads improved for a fraction of the cost that it would otherwise be. So several proposals came through, none of which were attractive to the people of PEI, and they spoke out very loudly and clearly and said, no, we don't want any of these proposals. So the government went away and came back literally about a week later with what has been called Plan B, which was never one of the original proposals, which was before the public, and they presented it as a done deal. In fact, the Minister of Transportation stood up at the one public meeting that we did have after Plan B was proposed and said, this is a done deal. And now that's, you can hardly refer to that as a consultative process. There was no consultation whatsoever.
And so, as listeners, I'm sure, noticed at the beginning, I was sort of fumbled with my notes there again. I just want to properly introduce you again. That's Peter Bevan Baker. And you're also a member of the Green Party in PEI. Is this a Green Party issue, or are you just out there as a citizen? What's the sort of political aspect to this having to do with your political affiliations?
Well, I mean, it's both. I'm the incoming leader of the Green Party of Prince Edward Island, and I can't hide that. And I have run 9 times for the Green Party over the last 20 years as a candidate. So I'm well known here. Prince Edward Island is small, and it's difficult to be anonymous here the best of times. But when you do stuff like that, people know who I am and what my affiliations are. But the group which sprung up when Plan B became a big issue here is very much a community group of concerned citizens. It was not a partisan group at all. We have people here from the NDP, there are Greens, there are a Conservative Party here, the opposition in the legislature have come out and opposed this as well. So no, this is very much a citizens group from the community which has just sprung up. By the way, all this traffic noise in the background, we're standing at the side of the highway here with our signs, and we've had tremendous public support.
And one of the other things I wanted to ask you about was on the outline as far as what the issues with the Plan B was the something called the pretense of safety. And what you outlined there is that transport officials admitted they used outside data on the Plan B site to, quote, improve the collision numbers. Now, I'm naturally someone who's very, very skeptical by nature. And for me, unless I see sort of an incentive to do that, I'm sort of confused as to why transportation officials would do that. So what would be their reason for wanting to improve these numbers? And I guess by connection, why would someone want to do this project if it wasn't the best option? Do you know what I'm getting at? What do you see their motivations are as trying to push ahead this project with potentially misleading information?
Hey, I know exactly what you're getting at, Darren. And first of all, the government is trying to justify the unjustifiable. This project is irrational any way you look at it, whether that's financially, ecologically, in every way. The building of this highway makes no sense at all. So the only way that they could try and justify the unjustifiable was to cook some statistics and try and persuade the public that this particular stretch of highway was uniquely dangerous or particularly dangerous, much more dangerous than the rest of the Trans-Canada here on the island. And they have not changed their tune. There was an hour-long radio call-in show this morning with the Minister of Transportation, who was pathetic, who kept coming back to the fact that this is a safety issue when it's been proven that the statistics they used were fudged. And much more so than that, even if there was a safety issue on this part of the highway, there are many, many other more efficient, more effective, cheaper ways of dealing with safety issues on our roads than building faster, straighter highways through old-growth forests. We should be spending... safety is not about road engineering. It's about driver behavior and public education. And if a fraction of the amount of money that they're going to waste on this highway that nobody on PEI wants and we don't need and can't afford, if a fraction of that money had been spent on public education and initiatives such as doing up your seatbelts, better enforcement of speed controls and impaired driving, which is a huge problem here on PEI. We have the highest rate of impaired driving in the country.
I was actually going to say, why don't they just stick a bunch of road bumps around the corners? But I guess if impaired driving is your biggest problem, that's not a good option.
No. So, yeah, you're right.
I don't drive, so I have no context for what that would do.
Yeah. So there's nothing sensible about this project. And the government has really struggled to try and justify it to the public, an increasingly skeptical and angry public, I might say. You know, we're known, PEI is the gentle island, but I'll tell you, the people of PEI have been riled up about this in a way that I have never, ever seen before.
So that gets me, I think, to the thing that I want to sort of like really crystallize and make really clear for myself. And so you've outlined how you said justify the unjustifiable. And so I'm still sort of looking for motivation on their behalf to do this. Like, what do you think the benefit for them is? Why would this project be pushed ahead if it's such a bad idea?
Well, there's one word, Darren, and it's patronage. Province is a small province, and that's a beautiful thing. And on many levels, there's an intimacy here, and a connection that we have with our elected officials, which is really quite charming. But there's also a dark side to that. And there is a small group of very powerful, very rich individuals here connected in at all levels of society who pull some strings which they should not be able to pull. And I think it's quite clear that this project is being pushed forward because there are friends of the government who are going to benefit hugely from this. There is a company here, Island Coastal, who are doing the major work here with very clear ties to the Liberal government. And there's no doubt in my mind that what is driving this is nothing more than patronage.
So another way that I've heard on political shows that described is something along like crony capitalism might be another way to describe
yep.
that.
Yep, yeah, that's a perfect phrase.
Okay. Yeah, no, I just, you know what I mean? Like, we just, you know, hear all the time, and I've read some of the articles that was put out. I've read your website. I've also read a couple of the articles that were in the major newspapers about this issue as well. And yep. it's another one of those issues and areas where, you know, it's kind of like reading two things night and day. When I read the mainstream media reports on this, they made, you know, for lack of a better term, they kind of made you sound like a bunch of lone nuts. And then you read your website, and it seems like in an open and shut case that they're, you know, this is an insane project, and who could possibly support it? I think this is a good case to bring up, sort of how difficult it can be for the public in general, you know, outside, removed from a local issue like this. To really make hide nor hair of it, right? Like, it can be that you're hearing two completely disparate stories, and people don't really know sort of who to trust. And I think this can be very confusing. And I think maybe this is why there's such a problem getting Canada at large to support kind of local issues, you know, why you don't have tons and tons of people in Vancouver writing letters or, you know, emails or getting excited about this issue. It's not because I don't think that they don't care. I think it's that, you know, for the average person, it's very difficult to sort of sort this all out, and that therefore, okay, well, I'm going to leave this one alone because I don't really know anything about it.
Yeah.
Do you understand? I mean, so how do we get through that then? I mean, this is one example, but let's blow it up into a bigger issue for our last question now. Let's kind of macro size this a little bit.
Yep.
How do we deal with this problem? How do you get support for people outside of PEI for an issue like this when it's very difficult for even, you know, the uninformed in PEI to get a handle on what's actually going on?
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's a very important question here, because there's only so much pressure that we as Islanders can put on our government, particularly if they've been completely intransigent and blind to all of our concerns. We've tried every avenue possible to get them to listen to this, from petitions to a public plebiscite, a citizen initiated plebiscite, where over 90% of the respondents responded against Plan B. So we have tried everything we possibly can, and now we're left with the option of civil disobedience, which is what we're doing. And I myself received a trespassing summons just 2 days ago for entering the work site, which, by the way, is on public land. I argued the case that it's my constitutional privilege, right, to be on public land. This is the people's land. How can I trespass on my own land? And I was met with some strangely unsympathetic RCMP officers. And Elizabeth May, you may have seen this, issued a press release just yesterday, I think it was, maybe the day before, demanding that the RCMP drop these charges immediately and that they're completely bogus. But it's publicity like that which is going to take this from a local issue to a national issue, because this is just representative of so many crazy things that government does, you know, without any heed to the will of the people and without any long-term respect for the environment and our democratic institutions. And yes, it would be lovely if this became a national story and our job would be made much easier, for sure. And I don't know how far this broadcast goes, Darren, but I would certainly call on anybody to try and find out about this as much as you can. And because I mentioned earlier, the size of PEI is very small, and we can influence government here if they are pushed far enough. And I think we're right at the edge, Darren. The government is flailing here. This is a rogue government which has failed to listen, stopped listening to the people. And I think they could be easily scared into canceling this. Not too late to cancel this project. And if there was national pressure from coast to coast, that would go a long way to doing that.
Absolutely. Well, you'll be thrilled to know that we actually have national coverage. There's people listening to us from coast to coast right now, Vancouver to St. John's. So we're all over the country are hearing your message. I'm gonna let you go on that note, but I think that's a perfect segue into our fundraising pitch. You know, we were talking about, you know, how do you get this sort of information out to people? Well, supporting the Green Majority is definitely a good way to do that. We're here to sort of spread these stories. So we want to thank you very much for joining us today, Peter Bevan-Baker. Incoming Green Party representative from PEI. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity, Darren.
And so that fundraising show will be on October the 19th. Fundraising week here is from the 15th to the 21st. So next week's show, I believe. Wow. Okay. So we're getting up close. Next week's show will be our fundraising show. So get ready. You can also get in. Remember, there's still time if you go in before the 15th to CIUT.FM. You don't need to add any www or anything like that. It's just CIUT.FM. You can go in and become a member if you do the minimum. Well, there's no minimum. You can give them like a dollar, I think, if you want to. But if you give them at least $25, and before the 15th, you can stand to win all these sort of extra prize packs. There's like an early bird draw, Center for the Performing Arts prize pack valued at $2,000, among many other things. There's all sorts of automatic gifts, hats and t-shirts and prize draws and all sorts of things that you can do. We're also going to see what we can do to get a few specific prizes on the air as well. Do you have any questions about that or anything about the interview? Or if you were sitting there wondering to ask Peter there a question, you didn't hear my earlier call out, we now will have Leo regularly sitting at the Twitter account. So you can send your questions, comments, concerns for live on-air guests or to ask us questions or anything you like. Go to Twitter and use at Green Majority. Send us a direct message or a post on our wall. And we'll try and get you involved on the program that way. It's a great way to interact with the show, and it helps us let us know if we're missing the mark, if you think we've totally missed asking an obvious question, or if you think I'm lobbing softballs at someone that needs to be grilled a little bit harder. You can go ahead. It doesn't have to be a question itself. It can just be, you know, any sort of spurtish comment, or you can be, you know, we probably won't read them on air. I don't think I'll ask Lee to read them on air, but, you know, you could even technically be like, you guys suck, because then that'll motivate me to try a little bit harder to do a better job. But I think we do a pretty decent job here. Anyway, we're going to go to a commercial, we're going to do a music break for a second. We'll be right back to hear a little bit about how food defines cities. Stay tuned. All right, and we are back. We're going to be hearing now from some more TED Talks, and just as well, we're not going to just play it, just play the clip anymore. Again, as I was mentioning before the break, we're going to try and see if we can bring up a little bit of the interaction with the live show. We've got lots of people sending us emails and stuff after the show, but we'd love it if people could kind of participate real time a little bit. So we're going to try that out. If you happen to be listening on a pre-record and would like to be able to hear the show live, or perhaps you're listening off of one of our wonderful syndicates across the country, you can go to iTunes The podcast function is currently not working. That's one of the things that I'm still working on fixing. However, we do have a bright, shiny new website, which is still a work in progress. But there's a lot of stuff back up there. I have a syndication page and whatnot. You can also go to CIUT.fm in addition to making an early donation to also find out the information on how to listen to CIUT directly streaming over iTunes under their radio player. So if you happen to be somewhere else in the country and you don't know, but you'd like to know how to listen live so that maybe you can interact with the show a little bit while it's taking place, you can go to iTunes or go to CIUT.fm to find that out as well if you can't find us on the iTunes radio for 89.5 FM. So what we'll be doing now is I'm going to play a clip from Carolyn Steele. This is her talking about how food and cities related, how food shapes our cities. And we're going to come back and we're going to jam about it for a minute or two before we move on in the program. So if while you're listening, you have any comments, questions or concerns or anything, any comments you'd like to make about anything that she says there, we're going to be having a little bit of a jam of it afterwards. You'll feel free to participate. So we're going to play the clip. It's about 10 minutes long. And then if you have anything in the meantime you'd like to say about it or any further comments, please do send us a comment to @GreenMajority on Twitter, and we'll get you included in the conversation. But for now, this is Carolyn Steele with How Food Shapes Our Cities.
How do you feed a city? It's one of the great questions of our time, yet it's one that's rarely asked. We take it for granted that if we go into a shop or a restaurant, or indeed into this theatre foyer in about an hour's time, there's going to be food there waiting for us, having magically come from somewhere. But when you think that every day for a city the size of London, enough food has to be produced, transported, bought and sold, cooked, eaten, disposed of, and that something similar has to happen every day for every city on Earth, it's remarkable that cities get fed at all. We live in places like this as if they're the most natural things in the world, forgetting that because we're animals and that we need to eat, we're actually as dependent on the natural world as our ancient ancestors were. And as more of us move into cities, more of that natural world is being transformed into extraordinary landscapes like the one behind me, a soybean field in Mato Grosso in Brazil, in order to feed us. These are extraordinary landscapes, but few of us ever get to see them. And increasingly, these landscapes are not just feeding us either. As more of us move into cities, more of us are eating meat, so that a third of the annual grain crop globally now gets fed to animals rather than to us human animals. And given that it takes 10 times as much grain to feed a human if it's passed through an animal first, that's not a very efficient way of feeding us. And it's an escalating problem too. By 2050, it's estimated that twice the number of us are going to be living in cities, and it's also estimated that there's going to be twice as much meat and dairy consumed. So meat and urbanism are rising hand in hand, and that's going to pose an enormous problem. 6 billion hungry carnivores to feed by 2050. That's a big problem, and actually, if we carry on as we are, it's a problem we're very unlikely to be able to solve. 19 million hectares of rainforest are lost every year to create new arable land, although at the same time we're losing an equivalent amount of existing arable to salinization and erosion. We're very hungry for fossil fuels too. It takes about 10 calories to produce every calorie of food that we consume in the West. And even though there's food that we're producing at great cost, we don't actually value it. Half the food produced in the USA is currently thrown away. And to end all of this, at the end of this long process, we're not even managing to feed the planet properly. 1 billion of us are obese, while a further 1 billion starve. None of it makes very much sense. And when you think that 80% of global trade in food now is controlled by just 5 multinational corporations, it's a grim picture. As we're moving into cities, the world is also embracing a Western diet. And if we look to the future, it's an unsustainable diet. So, how did we get here? And more importantly, what are we going to do about it? Well, to answer the slightly easier question first, about 10,000 years ago, I would say, is the beginning of this process. in the ancient Near East, known as the Fertile Crescent, because as you can see, it was crescent-shaped and it was also fertile. And it was here about 10,000 years ago that two extraordinary inventions, agriculture and urbanism, happened roughly in the same place and at the same time. And this is no accident, because agriculture and cities are bound together. They need each other. Because it was the discovery of grain by our ancient ancestors for the first time produced a food source that was large enough and stable enough to support permanent settlements. And if we look at what those settlements were like, we see they were compact, they were surrounded by productive farmland and dominated by large temple complexes like this one at Ur, that were in fact effectively spiritualized central food distribution centers, because it was the temples that organized the harvest, gathered in the grain, offered it to the gods, and then offered the grain that the gods didn't eat back to the people. So if you like, the whole spiritual and physical life of these cities was dominated by the grain and the harvest that sustained them. And in fact, that's true of every ancient city. But of course, not all of them were that small. Famously, Rome had about 1 million citizens by the first century AD. So how did a city like this feed itself? The answer is what I call ancient food miles. Basically, Rome had access to the sea, which made it possible for it to import food from a very long way away. This is the only way it was possible to do this in the ancient world, because it was very difficult to transport food over roads, which were rough, and the food obviously went off very quickly. So Rome effectively waged war on places like Carthage and Egypt just to get its paws on their grain reserves. And in fact, you could say that the expansion of the empire was really a sort of one long, drawn-out, militarized shopping spree, really. In fact, I love the fact, I just have to mention this, that Rome, in fact, used to import oysters from London at one stage. I think that's extraordinary. Anyway, so Rome shaped its hinterland through its appetite. But the interesting thing is, the other thing also happened in the pre-industrial world. If we look at a map of London in the 17th century, we can see that it's grain, which is coming in from the Thames along the bottom of this map. So the grain markets were to the south of the city, and then the roads leading up from them to Cheapside, which was the main market, were also grain markets. And if you look at the name of one of those streets, Bread Street, you can tell what was going on there 300 years ago. And the same, of course, is true for fish. Fish was, of course, coming in by river as well. Same thing. And, of course, Billingsgate famously was London's fish market, operating on site here until the mid-1980s, which is extraordinary, really, when you think about it. Everybody else was wandering around with mobile phones, you know, that looked like bricks, and then the sort of smelly fish happening sort of down on the port. This is another thing about food in cities. Once its roots into the city are established, they very rarely move. Meat is a very different story because, of course, animals could walk into the city. So much of London's meat was coming from the northwest, from Scotland and Wales. So it was coming in and arriving at the city at the northwest, which is why Smithfield, London's very famous meat market, was located up there. Poultry was coming in from East Anglia and so on to the northeast. I feel a bit like a weather woman doing this. Anyway, and so the birds were coming in with their feet protected with little canvas shoes. And then when they hit the eastern end of Cheapside, that's where they were sold, which is why it's called poultry. And in fact, if you look at the map of any city built before the industrial age, you can trace food coming into it. You can actually see how it was physically shaped by food, both by reading the names of the streets, which give you a lot of clues. Friday Street on the previous slide was where you went to buy your fish on a Friday. But also, you have to imagine it full of food, because the streets and the public spaces were the only places where food was bought and sold. And if we look at an image of Smithfield in 1830, you can see that it would have been very difficult to live in a city like this and be unaware of where your food came from. In fact, if you were having Sunday lunch, the chances were it was mooing or bleating outside your window about 3 days earlier. So this was obviously an organic city, part of an organic cycle. And then 10 years later, everything changed. This is an image of the Great Western in 1840, and as you can see, some of the earliest train passengers were pigs and sheep. So all of a sudden, these animals are no longer walking into market. They're being slaughtered out of sight and mind, somewhere in the countryside, and they're coming into the city by rail. And this changes everything. To start off with, it makes it possible for the first time to grow cities, really any size and shape in any place. Cities used to be constrained by geography. They used to have to get their food through very difficult physical means. All of a sudden, they're effectively emancipated from geography. And as you can see from these maps of London in the 90 years after the trains came, it goes from being a little blob that it was quite easy to feed by animals coming in on foot and so on, to a large splurge that it'd be very, very difficult to feed with anybody on foot, either animals or people. And of course, that was just the beginning. After the trains came cars. And really, this marks the end of this process. It's the final emancipation of the city from any apparent relationship with nature at all. And this is a kind of city that's devoid of smell, devoid of mess, certainly devoid of people, because nobody would have dreamt of walking in such a landscape. In fact, what they did to get food was they got in their cars, drove to a box somewhere on the outskirts, came back with a week's worth of shopping, and wondered what on earth to do with it. And this really is the moment when our relationship both with food and cities changes completely. Here we have food that used to be the centre, the social core of the city at the periphery. It used to be a social event, buying and selling food. Now it's anonymous. We used to cook. Now we just add water or, a little bit of an egg if you're making a cake or something. We don't smell food to see if it's okay to eat. We just read the back of a label on a packet. And we don't value food. We don't trust it. So instead of trusting it, we fear it. And instead of valuing it, we throw it away. One of the great ironies of modern food systems is that they've made the very thing they promised to make easier much harder. By making it possible to build cities anywhere in any place, they've actually distanced us from our most important relationship, which is that of us and nature. And also they've made us dependent on systems that only they can deliver that, as we've seen, are unsustainable. So what are we going to do about that? It's not a new question. 500 years ago, it's what Thomas More was asking himself. This is the frontispiece of his book Utopia, and it was a series of semi-independent city-states, if that sounds remotely familiar. A day's walk from one another where everyone was basically farming mad and grew vegetables in their back gardens and ate communal meals together and so on. And I think you could argue that food is a fundamental ordering principle of Utopia, even though More never framed it that way. And here's another very famous utopian vision, that of Ebenezer Howard, the Garden City. Same idea, series of semi-independent city-states, little blobs of metropolitan stuff with arable land around, joined to one another by railway. And again, food could be said to be the ordering principle of his vision. It even got built, but nothing to do with this vision that Howard had. And that is the problem with these utopian ideas, that they are utopian. Utopia was actually a word that Thomas More used deliberately. It was a kind of joke, because it's got a double derivation from the Greek. It can either mean a good place or no place, because it's ideal, it's an imaginary thing. We can't have it. And I think, as a conceptual tool for thinking about the very deep problem of human dwelling, that makes it not much use. So I've come up with an alternative, which is sitopia, from the ancient Greek sitos for food and topos for place. I believe we already live in sitopia. We live in a world shaped by food, and that if we realise that, we can use food as a really powerful tool, conceptual tool, design tool, to shape the world differently. So if we were to do that, what might sitopia look like? Well, I think it looks a bit like this. I have to use this light, it's just the look on the face of the dog. But anyway, this is... It's food at the centre of life, at the centre of family life, being celebrated, being enjoyed, people taking time for it. This is where food should be in our society. But you can't have scenes like this unless you have people like this. By the way, these can be men as well. It's people who think about food, who think ahead, who plan, who can stare at a pile of raw vegetables and actually recognise them. We need these people. They're part of a network. Because without these kinds of people, we can't have places like this. Here, I deliberately chose this because it is a man buying a vegetable. But networks, markets where food's been grown locally, it's come in, it's fresh, it's part of the social life of the city. Because without that, you can't have this kind of place, food that's grown locally and also is part of the landscape and is not just a zero-sum commodity off in some unseen hellhole. Cows with a view. Steaming piles of hummus, this is basically bringing the whole thing together. And this is a community project I visited recently in Toronto. It's a greenhouse where kids get told all about food and growing their own food. Here's a plant called Kevin, or maybe it's a plant belonging to a kid called Kevin, I don't know. But anyway, these kinds of projects that are trying to reconnect us with nature is extremely important. So Zootopia for me is really a way of seeing. It's basically recognizing that Zootopia already exists in little pockets everywhere. The trick is to join them up, to use food as a way of seeing. And if we do that, we're going to stop seeing cities as big, metropolitan, unproductive blobs like this. We're going to see them more like this, as part of the productive, organic framework of which they are inevitably a part, symbiotically connected. But of course, that's not a great image either, because we need not to be producing food like this anymore. We need to be thinking more about permaculture, which is why I think this image just sums up for me the kind of thinking we need to be doing. It's a reconceptualization of the way food shapes our lives. The best image I know of this is from 650 years ago. It's Ambrogio Lorenzetti's Allegory of Good Government. It's about the relationship between the city and the countryside. And I think the message of this is very clear. If the city looks after the country will look after the city. And I want us to ask now, what would Ambrogio Lorenzetti paint if he painted this image today? What would an allegory of good government look like today? Because I think it's an urgent question. It's one we have to ask. And we have to start answering. We know we are what we eat. We need to realize that the world is also what we eat. But if we take that idea, we can use food as a really powerful tool to shape the world better. Thank you very much.
And we are back. That was Carolyn Steele talking about the relationship between foods and cities, a little bit about good governance there. It was a little bit of a geek out for me because that's coming very much from an urban studies planning background, which is partially what I've been studying. But I think there's definitely some highlight points to pull out of that if maybe you came in halfway through or... I know sometimes if speakers are getting into heavy detail, sometimes you can lose the immediacy of the interest of that. So for anyone that wasn't able to maybe kind of get through that, because I know what she was talking about was a bit dense. The important sort of points there to pull out that she was identifying was just the idea that, you know, in the world today, more and more people are moving to cities, but that we can't function without, obviously, rural areas. We have to grow our own food. She made some really interesting points there about Rome and how the only reason why they were able to have a city of a million people in ancient Rome was because of the access to waterways and to be able to ship in their food. And that basically, in many ways, a culture is sort of defined culturally by the food that they eat, but has very physical limitations put on it by the access to food that they want to eat. And so I think the most interesting quote there from her was that, you know, we are what we eat, and that is both applies to both people and to cultures and to cities physically, in that, you know, what is available to you is if it allows what you can do. I think there's definitely some implications there around planning for the future, some interesting things to think about. If you have 2 cents you'd like to drop us about that, just a reminder as well that you can now interact with the show live. We're paying attention during the show when it is broadcast on Friday mornings here in Toronto between 11 and noon. If you happen to be on one of our syndicates, you can listen through iTunes and participate. If you already are listening live, go ahead and send us a tweet at Green Majority if you have any comments or suggestions about any of the features. Have a question, perhaps. I may not know the answer, but if you ask a good question, you know what? I'll find it out for you and bring it on the next show. So for all that's for now, for my suggesting about Twitter, you can go ahead and do that while we're now hearing our international headlines with Leah Mazzolini.
Thanks, Darren. Oil giant Shell will be defending its environmental record after 4 Nigerian villagers slapped the company with a lawsuit. The 4 fishermen and farmers, as well as Friends of the Earth campaign group, are accusing the oil company of polluting land and water in the Niger Delta, taking the oil major to court on Thursday, October 11th. In defense, Shell is refusing responsibility, claiming the blame should be on the oil thieves and that the company has played their part in cleaning up. In a statement, they said the Nigerian oil thieves take about 150,000 barrels of oil every day, causing leaks abroad. Yet Friends of the Earth say that they hope the case will set a precedent and lead to put what they say an end to corporate crimes committed by oil giants like Shell in Nigeria and around the world. The company is the largest oil and gas company in Nigeria, with production capacity of more than 1 million barrels of oil per day. After record-breaking summer heat in the U.S., it looks like most Americans have a change of heart when it comes to man-made global warming. According to a Yale and George Mason study, a whopping 74% of Americans believe that human-induced climate change is occurring. This is a 5% points boost since the last study conducted in March of this year. Some of the highlights of the study include that 61% of Americans say weather in the U.S. has been getting worse over the past few years, a 9% jump from the last study. Twice as many Midwesterners say that they personally experience an extreme heat wave, sitting at 83%, up 48 points. When asked about drought, 81% of Midwesterners say they've experienced the weather anomaly, which is up 55 points from March. One in five Americans say they've endured health, poverty, and/or financial issues from the extreme heat wave this past summer, which is also up 6 points. Norway is committing to double the carbon tax on the oil industry next year, which will establish a fund over €1 billion to help develop developing nations protect forests and combat the effects of climate change. Norway is the world's 8th largest oil exporter and is set to raise its carbon tax of offshore oil companies by €26 to €46 per ton of carbon dioxide. The Oslo government also plans to invest over €1 billion into climate change mitigation, renewable energy, food security for developing nations, and conversion of low-carbon energy sources. €85 million will go towards helping offset its emissions, making homes carbon neutral by 2015, and increase efforts to gouge emissions by switching to electric vehicles. However, some economists predict that the labor-led government will announce even higher spending plans due to next year's elections, due to winning over voters. Currently, opinion polls show the shift in power in favor of conservative policies. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. We're going to send you back to the Twitter desk, as it were. We're going to have another commercial. I keep saying commercial. I'm just anticipating being on big commercial radio, I think. Maybe that's what that is. Anyway, we're going to take another music break. We'll be back to have a discussion. There was an article in Toronto's Now magazine about whether or not e-bikers should be allowed in bike lanes. We're going to jam with Leah and Kevin Farmer, the house pundit here, right after we come back for this music break. Stay tuned.
Thank
Paul Radin. We are back. You're listening to The Green Majority, greenmajority.ca, here on Canada's Environmental News Hour. That's 89.5 FM if you're listening in Toronto or one of our wonderful community radio partners across the country. Just another reminder, of course, the next week, the 19th, live, no matter where you are, you can listen over iTunes, is our fundraising show. We do a couple of fundraisers here a year because CIUT is an entirely, not entirely funded, but entirely existent upon community support. A lot of the alternative programming that you hear on this station, particularly on this show, if you're listening at one of our other syndicates, is entirely dependent on listener support. They don't get all their funding from listeners. There is some government support and other stuff like that, but definitely not enough to run the station by any means. I was actually having a little look at the numbers and the other day, and you know, we're just doing fine. The only community station in Toronto, if you happen to be listening in Toronto, and definitely the only environmental news hour in Canada as well. So really good reasons to support the program, and we do actually need your support to continue doing the program. Specifically, both through the station. I mean, community radio is really important to support anywhere, but I think we're doing some really amazing things here at CIUT, and particularly on the Green Majority, outlined with things like, for instance, our feature a while ago that I keep referencing just because I think it was such a disparity between about having to do with vegan food, or sorry, not vegan food, having to do with organic food and farming, the disparity between what's being said in the media and what the science is actually saying about it. This morning, again, there's almost no coverage that's supportive of issues such as the Plan B highway in PEI. All wonderful reasons and more to help support the Green Majority and CIUT, so you can stay tuned for that. We're now going to go to Kevin Farmer, who I've got on the line. How are you doing, Kevin?
Hi, Darren.
And so today we've got about 10 minutes left, and what I wanted to sort of jam about, and this is something where Leah's gone back. She may be participating, but she's back in front of the Twitter feed there, so if anyone has any questions or comments or concerns about this conversation, feel free to interact live by sending us a message at Twitter. But the message that I got here was Now Magazine talking about whether or not e-bikes should be allowed in bike lanes. And I thought this was a particularly interesting issue because while it may seem sort of like a small issue, apparently, especially if you're a driver of a car, but they've sort of fallen in between the cracks. I mean, the city of Toronto was not specifically, and most cities were not designed for heavy bike traffic to start with. So the issue of bike lanes has been an ongoing one. We've had Toby Bowers, who's sort of participating via email today, sent me a response to this article because he was unable to join us live. Toby Bowers is the director of Bike Chain here on the campus for the University of Toronto. And a general round all around, I don't know if he wants to be called an expert, but I'm going to go ahead and call him a bike expert and advocate. And it's sort of interesting because, you know, while we're getting all this sort of kerfuffle about, you know, where there should be bike lanes and how many bike lanes, there's other issues, too, which the coming up around whether or not e-bikes should be let in. And the reason I thought this was an interesting issue was it helps redefine the lines a little bit of the conversation, in my opinion, in that, you know, where do you put the dividing line, I guess, you know, between are we talking about alternate lanes for alternate environmental more environmentally friendly transportation to help encouraging it? Are we looking at ways to declog congestion on roads? Depending on how you sort of come at the problem, there's a whole lot of different answers. And I wondered, we'll start with sort of what you had to say about your reaction to the article and to Toby's comments as well a little bit. Just about, you know, sort of, I mean, I guess a good place to start is this even a real issue? And what is your opinion on yes or no if e-bikes should be allowed in bike lanes?
Well, I think, So I am a cyclist and I am a motorist and I am a pedestrian, and I think I've got a pretty good view of the issues about how I know how difficult it is to drive in traffic and how stressful it is. I know how difficult it is to navigate Toronto on a bicycle, and I know how dangerous it can be to step off the curb as a pedestrian. I can understand why cyclists don't want anything else in their lanes because they fought long and hard to get what they've got, which is not nearly enough. Like, we, you know, first of all, there's an inadequate supply of cycling lanes as it is, and they're not connected, and there's no sort of cycling thoroughfare through the city to get you to, you know, major destinations without having to leave the safety of the cycling lane and you know, sort of barge into traffic. So I can understand why cyclists don't want anything else in there, but when it comes to these some of these e-bikes, they have very low speed limits, And some of them are required to not exceed 32 kilometers an hour, which is not enough to keep up with traffic in some cases. So in their case, I would say it's dangerous for them to be driving in regular traffic. If they can't keep up, people are going to be trying to find ways to get around them, and that just leads to lane sharing, which is extremely dangerous for whoever is on the two-wheeled vehicle. If you take the motorcycle driving course, they teach you how to drive defensively, and it includes the concept of the blocking position. You'll notice motorcyclists often ride far to the right or to the left of the lane that they're in, and it is you'd expect them to be just sort of driving straight down the middle when they're not. They're off to either side, and there's a reason for that, because they're in the position that has the greatest chance of discouraging a car from sharing the lane with them. And it's different for different circumstances. I won't go into the details, but to drive defensively on a motorcycle, you're taught the blocking position, and in different traffic situations, it's a different position, and it's usually to the left or to the right of the lane that you're in. And I've never seen any e-bikes or scooters using their blocking position. They're always far over to the right, possibly because they're not fast enough to match traffic speeds. And that just encourages everyone to share a lane going around them, and that's extremely dangerous. I wouldn't want to be on an e-bike or a scooter under those circumstances. So, you know, if they're speed limited, I would say they deserve the safety of the bicycle lane. One side comment though is that not all of these forms of transportation are actually environmentally friendly. Scooters that run on gasoline, for instance, are by no means environmentally friendly. They're extremely polluting vehicles. They're very small. They don't have the pollution mitigation equipment that you'll find in a modern car.
And I don't know about people in other cities, but in Toronto, I see with maybe the frequency of one a month. So not a ton, but something that I've seen regularly enough that there's definitely more than just a couple of people that have them, which is sort of homemade scooters with what look to be like gas lawnmower engines strapped on the back and stuff like that. And those are some of the most polluting engines that exist. So, I mean,
oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, that should be a fine.
I'm pretty sure that those are illegal, but it doesn't seem to stop people, because I've seen dozens of them for sure, at least if not more. I think one of the things I wanted to kind of get at, though, was a little bit, was sort of the sort of classification issue that gets brought up here, because there's a whole bunch of ways to decide whether or not something could share in this kind of, you know, if you call it a bike lane, then it sort of seems to imply, presuppose that nothing else should be in that lane. But if you sort of call it alternative transport lane, that opens up a bunch of other possibilities, and it depends what you want to classify as it, right? So it could be pedal powered or electric only, but no, you know, with speed limits and no gas. You could say that the only things allowed in there are things that are people powered, but then that opens up the issue of, okay, well, does that mean that wheelchairs get to use the alternative transport lane? If you're going to include anything with just two wheels, then do motorcycles get to use it, you know, with the size? And so I just want to sort of impress the idea upon people that this is a far more sticky issue when you're actually getting down to, you know, to get from the concept stage to get to the actual law stage. There's a lot of sticky issues that need to be decided on, and I think there's a lot of stuff that just hasn't been defined. However, I would like to make the case that I think an option, I haven't made up my mind on this issue, and it doesn't sound, Kevin, like you necessarily have 100% made up your mind on it either. But one thing I'd like people to think about as well is that if you're talking about, like, for instance, in the city of Toronto, where it's been very, you know, we've been fighting tooth and nail for every inch of bike lane that we've gotten, and sometimes, unfortunately, they've been reversed after the fact to waste even more taxpayer money. That's a separate issue. But the idea of, if you, you know, a lot of the time the argument for this is, will they be enough, you know, is there enough actual use of them to justify having the bike lane? And, you know, depending on which numbers you look at, you know, people like Toby would say there's more than enough. Other people who have different priorities and different interests might say there's not nearly enough to justify taking away space from cars, which is how they're looking at it. But if you start adding on all these alternative transports, and sort of the alternative transport under that umbrella learns to kind of work together, you could definitely have much more of a critical mass, right? If you start grouping all the people on bikes, with all the people on e-scooters, with all the people on this, with all the people on that, to skateboards and stuff. Now all of a sudden you've tripled or quadrupled the number of people that are, that can use these lanes. Then maybe you'll have enough support for it to get tons more bike space, you know. So I'm not really, I'm sort of permanently undecided, I think, at this point on whether or not this is a good idea. I think depending on how you go about it, it could be a great idea. But what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think I'm still sort of leaning towards, you know, the speed limit of the vehicle that can use it. You know, if you can match traffic speeds, then you should probably be in traffic. I believe there's certainly more than enough usage of these lanes, and I think more people would use them if they were interconnected. And that's, you know, one of the biggest arguments is that, like you said, there's this argument that they put in bike lanes on streets and no one uses them. But you know, the larger picture is that a cyclist just doesn't want to take any kind of long trip through the city that's going to involve driving with traffic. And unfortunately, that's the case here, because none of our bike sort of nexi are connected. They're all just independent. You'll find a bike lane on a street, and then it just ends with no connecting bike lane.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today, though. I think definitely some interesting issues to get to. We will continue that sort of theme next week a little bit, and hopefully we'll get some people to jump in with some questions or comments from that Twitter account. That is all the time we have, though. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Darren.
You've been listening to The Green Majority, Canada's all-environmental news hour. Our program is produced live every Friday at CIUT and is available on campus and community stations from coast to coast, as well as being internet immortalized at our brand new spanking greenmajority.ca. I'm Darren Kaser, and that's it for today's live edition of The Green Majority. Until next week, thanks for listening.